Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous Reads with Polly Clark, author of Tiger. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Polly.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
It's actually a return to Radio Gorgeous. You were on Radio Gorgeous for your very first novel, Larchfield.
Yes, I was. And we were just saying just before that it was the first sort of publicity thing I'd ever done, or first recording I'd made to do with my book. So yeah, we've come a long way.
Exactly. Radio Gorgeous, here to pop your cherry.
Yeah. And beyond.
Exactly, as it were. Let's talk about Tiger. It says it in the name, but you introduce it to us.
Well, Tiger is the main thing that I always want people to understand about Tiger is that it is absolutely full of real tigers. So I didn't, when I wrote this novel, although it has lots of people in it and, you know, there's a lot of big story in there, I didn't want to write a book full of symbolic tigers, which is what people mostly do with tigers. They exoticize them. And so this isn't kind of a version of Life of Pi or The Jungle Book, My Tigers Don't Talk. I've put in a lot of research and experience to make them as real as possible. So I hope you actually encounter tigers in my novel.
It is a tiger encounter. And it's also, for me, it was primarily a book about relationships. There's the circular relationship that connects the main human characters and the main tiger characters, but also within that, there's filial relationships with Thomas. Frida is all about partner relationships, sexual relationships. For Edith, being a wife, mother. For Luna and Xena, being a daughter, they are all, and the Empress, who's Luna's mother, the tigress, the Empress of the Siberian forest. Those relationships are very mirrored.
Yes, I wanted to do that very much. I mean, I'm very interested in how the tiger story, the Siberian tiger particularly, being a roaming animal, being very solitary, isolated, and very successful. That's a survival strategy. So the male, for instance, has a territory of 500 square miles with the female's territories within that. They're not social in the way that we are, but they're an apex creature, and they're a perfect manifestation of their environment. And I wanted to use that explore that as a way of being, you know, contrasted with other ways of being. So there's also bonobos in the novel, which have a whole other, they're also apex creatures, but they're non-hierarchical, they're very social, highly sexed. And with those two animal extremes, then that gave me this really interesting canvas to show the people's relationships and how, and ways of being human, ways of being female, with those two as a kind of backdrop.
There is an extremity in the environment that does make the humans in that extreme cold have to act like instinctual animals. And so those relationships are even more mirrored.
Yes, absolutely.
Because in that extreme cold, one decision determines your survival or not.
Yes.
And the Empress has to make those decisions, and they all have to make those decisions.
Yes. I mean, in the I did go to this particular region, which is the last place where these tigers live, because that environment is so hostile and so that the Amur tiger is so perfectly adapted to it. You don't understand the tiger without experiencing that environment. And the people, there are very few pockets of people who exist alongside the tiger. So there's still an indigenous tribe, the Adegi people, who are mostly they used to be nomadic, but they're mostly in a village now. And then there are also bands of disenfranchised men from the period of state-owned industry, which has all died in that region, who exist in the forest. So, and the only way you can exist in that environment is exactly as the tiger does it. There is no other way. It's truly wild. There is no food in winter. You have to be able to coexist, live alongside, and be completely independent. And I wanted, especially in Frida, the zookeeper who kind of starts the whole story, her way of healing and coming to terms with herself, she learns from that way of being. I was very interested in not only how close can you really be to a wild animal like that, that's an alien consciousness to human, but also what can you learn from that? And yeah, I was able to follow that through, and it was fascinating, and just as a project for myself.
One of the things that I always think when you say we fetishize animals and we sort of give them this personification and these human attributes, but we don't actually believe they have them. And one of the things that is explored in this is animal memory. You know, and we see it demonstrated in elephants. And these tigers, and it is sort of known, talk to me a little bit about that, about that,
yeah.
That this is their territory, and mm-hmm. any infraction.
Yes. I mean, usually if people want to research tigers and write about tigers, they go to India, where you hop on an elephant, you go in the reserve, and you can just see them. The Siberian tiger, you don't see them. So when I went on this trip, the big USP of the whole thing was... you know, you're not going to see one. It's very expensive, extremely unpleasant, and you're not going to see one except on a camera trap. These particular tigers were interesting to me because they have this long memory and this particular survival characteristic of avenging, of revenge. And when I had this idea that this particular type of revenge would be important in the book, that meant I had to actually experience these specific tigers. So yes, the male has this enormous territory, the king tiger he's called, and obviously he can't be in all places at once when he's patrolling. He spends his life patrolling, but he can't be in all places at once. So there's a climate of fear to maintain control over very scarce resources. In winter it's minus 35, snow, I mean there's just nothing there. He has to create this climate of fear, and he does that by punishing any infraction that he comes across. So there are a couple of wonderful non-fiction books about this, but if you try and kill a Siberian tiger and you don't succeed, it will devote its days to finding you and killing you. And that applies to its nearest kin, and legend has it also to its food as well. It's extraordinary that kind of not social, but with a huge memory and this grudge holding. Fantastic.
To me, it sounds like a mafia boss.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And this is one of the other things that writing the book brought home to me, is how similar we are, how our social structures arise out of our environment. So I was very interested in, so for instance, the bonobos having this very flat matriarchal structure. Well, that's in a situation where resources are unlimited. So, I mean, they're very endangered. Their habitat is disappearing. But when they're just in their normal lives and their environment, their resources are unlimited. As soon as resources become scarce, it turns into a patriarchy. And the Siberian tiger is the ultimate patriarchy. Mm-hmm. So our own ideas of capitalism and patriarchy and who's at the top... It's a very small amount of thinking required to see that we are also responding to either a real scarcity in resources or a perceived one. We think we're being very human, don't we?
But the patriarchy, you know, some people would argue, creates a false sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Of that need for them.
Yes,
in
absolutely.
Order to maintain the power.
Yes.
You have achieved what you wanted.
Oh, great.
In terms of it being an incredibly immersive book. Each of the human stories is as submersive as the tigers.
I'm glad, yeah.
And it's absolutely wonderful. I highly, highly recommend it. It's so exciting to see also how different the book is from Larchfield and mm-hmm. how you are changing as a writer from poet to novelist. To second novelist. Uh-huh. Tell me how this story came to you.
Well, I had, in a way, the original idea or interest in tigers predates Larchfield.
Yes,
so I didn't
I
have
understand.
That problem.
You were a zookeeper.
Yes, I'd written a lot about animals and about tigers in my poetry. So I didn't have the problem that a lot of second novelists have where they're scratching around for an idea after their debut. I had it there. But the idea of this bigger story where I would be bringing the tigers in their own environment to life, that it would kind of reach out in this sort of bigger way to tell a bigger story, that evolved a little bit, and then it sort of exploded once I'd been on the trip. I mean, I think the experience of Larchfield gave me the confidence. I don't think I'd have had the confidence to take the sort of leap that this was. You know, it's more complicated, and as a process, it was very immersive to write. And I had to go somewhere I really didn't want to go to sort of do it. And the whole thing was very open-ended like that. So the first novel gave me the confidence, but the interest and the longing to explore certain questions and relationships that were very important to me, just personally, that came later. The drive was there, but the ability to do it kind of came later.
Larchfield, in some ways, mirrored some of your experiences. Mm. In part, it is a book about a young mother, isolated, trapped by motherhood, fearful and depressed a bit. You now have a houseboat in London.
Yes.
Your horizons have broadened.
Yes.
And you like the King Tiger, have a very broad territory.
Yes, I'm roaming. Oh my goodness. Yeah, yes. I don't do much punishment of infraction, so I haven't spotted them yet. So I think that that's true, that I mean, I feel that very much, that when you've written a novel, it's a very, well, for me anyway, it's a very almost, you know, it's a physical, it's a full body, full life experience, and you are a different person afterwards. So in Larchfield, I did answer a really important question for myself, which was I really needed it to be possible that you could connect even in the most separated of circumstances. So, you know, I had two protagonists, you know, one of, you know, fictional, and one of whom was dead even when he had not been fictional. So, you know, I made it as impossible as I could for them to ever help each other, and yet, you know, it managed to unfold like that, which was very hopeful for me personally. So with this book, in a way, it's like that, you know, the big drivers and the sort of the transformation it's wrought in me. I suppose I was able in this book to look at my own female experience from all angles. I mean, there's just every way of being female in this book, and yet somehow it feels quite universal. So it's wonderful to have written a book which does, I mean, it does have the men in there, and they're really important, but there is every aspect that I know about of female experience in there. So we've got, you know, girl, woman, mother, childless woman, menopause. The whole thing is in there, expressed in, explored in different ways. And I felt completely satisfied that I'd been able to talk about all those things and think about all those things and come out the other side with a much deeper understanding of myself as an animal, as a female, and as a person on a planet, in an environment. So yes, it's done a lot for me personally, and that's what you hope for, you know, when you write a novel.
I have to say, some of the most difficult decisions that your female characters make are around self-love, self-determination, mm-hmm. self-love, mm-hmm. self-care.
Yes.
And how to do that. Best, successful ways, unsuccessful ways, but that they really have to struggle with that. And I think that is one of the things, centrally to women still.
Yes.
We can see these roles, and yet the ones where we have to take care of ourselves or forge something for ourselves or decide for ourselves,
yes.
are some of the most difficult decisions we make.
Yes, absolutely. And what are you if you're not doing those things? So I was very interested in, so edit Odagi Huntress and her daughter. So she begins her part of the story in the village with her husband, and I cried buckets over Valeri and Edit, her husband, because, you know, he loves her, and he really wants her to be happy. And there was just this idea that if somebody comes from your oppressor class, you know, so he's a Russian, the Russians have intermarried with the indigenous people, and this is true in real life. So, you know, they are responsible for it, sort of obliterating their distinctiveness as a tribe. So how can you ever really love this person, no matter how marvelous they are and how close you have become? There's always, and there's a moment in there where Edith realizes this, that she can forgive him for all his trespasses, but she can never love him. So even if they stay married, it's over. And I was really upset about that. And then I wanted to see then, could she succeed in the forest as a huntress with her daughter without that mechanism of, you know, her roles back in the village? Would it actually be easier to be facing tigers and bears with your child in the forest as they used to live nomadically? And it was wonderful to actually follow that through and also have the tiger mother and her way of being a mother. And actually, there was a huge part of it that made me realise that the big problem, even in the forest, is childcare. Because the tiger has to leave her cubs to go and hunt. And, you know, that's an issue. Even so, you have to be, you know, you're the tiger, you know, creature. You have instinct. You're the only one left with these cubs. They haven't, they look after them for 2.5 years. They have very strong attachments, but you have to be able to leave them. If they're sick, you have to be able to abandon them. And I found that a really interesting counterpoint when I sent my own huntress with her daughter to face what would be the same challenges. So she has to leave her child. So it was seeing what happens when either willingly or unwillingly you're out of your accepted role, and to follow that through.
Okay, one last question. What was minus 35 degrees like?
Well, as long as you had the kit. So I had to spend an absolute eye-watering sum on the proper kits, because if you haven't got the right clothes, you'll, you know,
die
in half an hour. So they, but it's a very dry cold, so it feels like kind of hornets, you know, stings, rather than and when you first go out, you don't necessarily feel it as being as dangerous as it might be, But yeah, it's more like being stung or burned than it is like the British cold, which has a raw quality because it's wet. There is no kind of damp quality, so it doesn't feel unpleasant. It's just there as a lethal element. Yeah.
Well, I would suggest taking to a sun lounger, yeah, and feeling nice and toasty warm, but getting all the delicious chills of the Siberian.
Yes, that's what I hope. I hope you actually really feel, you know, experience that. That was a big part of what I wanted to do. That you know, so I went so that you don't have to. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
And thank you so much, Polly Clark.
Oh, lovely to be here. Thank you, Donna.